Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network podcast. I am Roberto Mazza, the host of the Jerusalem Unplugged podcast. And today, for the Middle Eastern Studies series, my guests are Dr. Sarah Irving and Dr. Shabel Nassif. They will introduce and discuss the new book that they have edited together with Karen Sanchez-Summerer, who is not today present for the recording of this podcast, The House of a Priest, A Palestinian Life, 1885-1954, published by Brill in 2022 and available as open access. The link will be posted in the description of the episode. The House of a Priest presents and discusses the unpublished and untranslated memoirs of Nikhla Khoury, who was a senior member of the Orthodox Church and Arab Nationalist Party in Palestine in the late Ottoman and British Mandate era. With Sarah and Shabel, we will discuss the life of Nikhla Khoury, the context into which he developed his activity, both as a priest and as a nationalist. And we will look into some of the details about his memoirs, and particularly how to read and make good use of what he left with us. Before moving forward, let me briefly introduce my guest. So Sarah Irving is currently a lecturer in Middle Eastern history at Staffordshire University and editor of the journal Contemporary Levant. She has worked and traveled in Palestine, Jordan, and Israel for over 25 years in fields including journalism and fair trade, as well as academic research. Dr. Shabel Nassif is currently the chief archivist and librarian of the Melkite Greek Catholic Patriarchate. He is also a researcher at the Center de Documentation et de Recherche Arabe Chrétienne at the St. Joseph University in Beirut. And previously, between 2018 and 2019, he was a postdoctoral fellow at Leiden University. And it's in the context of a Crossroads-funded project, Europeans, Cultural Diplomacy, and Arab Christians in Mandate Palestine, 1918 and 1948, that this project took shape, and it was eventually co-edited by Dr. Irving, Shabel Nassif, and as I said earlier, Professor Karen Sanchez. Before moving forward and talking about the book, Sarah and Shabel, welcome.
Thank you very much.
So my first question goes to each and one of you, and I'm probably going to start with Sarah. Can you tell us a little bit more about your background and also how did you come to work on this book? And the same question will be for Shabel. If you can tell us after Sarah a little bit about your background and perhaps together, how did you get to work on the memoirs of Nikhla Khoury and how you came to publish it?
Thank you for that, Roberto. I suppose in terms of origins, my background is quite boring. I'm a middle-class British woman from South London. But I always had a wide range of kind of political and activist interests from my early teens onwards. And at one point in my life, Palestine kind of became one of them. And sort of for various reasons, that kind of segued from being something that I did as an activist to something that I started to research, and particularly Mandate, late Ottoman and Mandate history. I kind of like to mention this because I know that it gives encouragement to some people who are worried about the idea of going back to university later in life. But I returned to university in my late 30s, did a PhD in my late 30s and early 40s. And after kind of a number of other research and teaching jobs, as you mentioned, I'm now a lecturer at Staffordshire University in the history department there. So I've worked and taught in a lot of different places, in Britain and Europe and the Middle East, but that's where I am now. And the book, and Michabel will be able to talk a bit more about the origins of this, but one of the postdoctoral roles that I had very briefly was with the Crossroads Project in Leiden. Chabelle and Karen had already found this manuscript and started to work on it, but didn't have enough time in their own kind of roles to take it on. So she asked me, particularly in terms of the fact that from before my academic life, I had been involved in kind of editing and proofreading and copy editing, if I could kind of take this on as a project. So I kind of came in partway through a project that had been initiated by Chabelle and Karen, which he can talk more about.
So, in fact, I'm more art historian and theologian. I'm not historian. When I finished my two PhDs, I was assigned as archivist of the Amalekite Patriarchate. And I knew about the research of Crossroads, the project funded by the Netherlands National Research Agency. So when I was preparing my PhD, I worked a lot on archives in Rome. And it was a good experience for me. And after, I worked also on archives in Lebanon in many monasteries. So when I had this postdoc, Karen came to Lebanon, and we were planning to visit many institutions. So we went to the American University of Beirut, and we went also to Institute of Palestine Studies in Beirut, in Verda. And there we find many sheets like archives, like an index of archives. And there we find journal of Nicholas Khoury. Karen had the intuition, oh, it seems interesting. So we asked to see this document. We saw it for maybe 10, 15 minutes. And after, she told me, Charbel, it will be more really important to publish this journal. I'm supposed to work on Melkite Christianity, on Greek Catholic. I wrote an article on Greek Catholic, on Yoros Hajar in the volume, but she told me, no, we should work on this book. So I visited many, many times the institute to copy all these manuscripts to Arabic and then to translate it in English with Vicky Musaid. So both were translating the work in English. I was correcting her work because, you know, we have some terms in theology, in history, in many things that not every translated could do it. And after Sarah reviewed all the work with all that correction, and we have many va-et-vient to publish this book. And of course, thanks to Salim Tamari from the Institute of Palestine Studies, we have the authorization, the permission to publish this journal.
I guess my next question is, let's start from scratch. Who was Nicola Khoury?
Yes. So Nicola Khoury, he was born in Birzeit, in Palestine, in July 1885. He came from an Orthodox family, from middle class. He was not rich and he was not poor. His father was a priest. He was ordained priest. His father, while Nicola Khoury had 6 years old. After he moved to Jordan, he moved to Karak when he was 14 years old, because his father was assigned a priest there. After they sent him to Jerusalem, to the seminary of Jerusalem, for many years. And there we find in the journal that he was a very good student there. He was really intelligent, as he said. After he came back to Karak, and he was assigned as a teacher there. We can consider that the beginning of Nicola's political commitment begins on Karak, when he became a member of the Young Turks Association. We can say that his father maybe forced him to marry, and he had two children, Mariam and Takla. After the revolution in Karak in 1910, he returns to Palestine. And as you told us, it was a so difficult journey. If you read page 84, for example, our journey from Ziza to Madaba was also a perilous one. In the dark of the night, we lost our way, roaming in a rank, wet lane, sinking up to our knees in mud. If it were not for the kind mercy of the Creator, we would have succumbed. So in Palestine, in 1911, he was assigned as a teacher in the school in Ramla. During the First World War, he was first assigned the position of clerk of the clothing and munition warehouse in Jerusalem, and then of the officer responsible for issuing stores. In 1922, he moved to Jerusalem, and after 6 years, he was ordained priest. Maybe now Sarah would like to continue the rest of the biography of Nicola.
Sarah, apologies, you need to open your microphone.
In the 1920s, I think we can say maybe that Nicola's priorities and his involvements split into two main strands. One is that he is a local priest. He's a man with a growing family. He moves around in his job on a number of occasions. He also has various family troubles that he talks about involving. You know, the normal things that happen to any family of bereavements. One of his brothers becomes mentally ill and ends up disappearing, which is a very sad story. So there's kind of the complexities of everyday life that we get a little bit of a glimpse of in the book, but also more in terms of the kind of the public life. He's a priest, but he's very much part of the movement within the Greek Orthodox Church to Arabize the church, to use the Arabic language instead of Greek, for Arabs to be ordained and promoted to higher positions in the church instead of just Greek clergy. And this kind of, you know, and this is something that there's quite an abundant literature about already, the relationship of this movement to Arab and to Palestinian nationalism more generally. So he also becomes associated with the anti-colonial nationalist movement within Palestine. He's kind of the faction of the Husseini family. So the kind of, in some ways, the kind of mainstream of Jerusalemite and Palestinian nationalist activity. And I mean, we'll talk about this later on, but he does on a couple of occasions have some sort of fairly important roles within particular projects. So this is kind of the sort of life he has up until the Nakba in 1948. And then he moves for sort of the final years of his life to Lebanon after the Nakba. And goes back in some ways, I think, to, we could say, goes back to being a local priest who is mainly concerned with his family and his village.
We will go back to the question of the Nakba as a crucial period, but I'm curious here a little bit about the general context for listeners that might not be entirely familiar with the role of the Greek Orthodox Church in Palestine. And given that the story takes place in the Greek Orthodox landscape of the region, can you tell us a little bit more about the question of the Arab laity and clergy vis-a-vis the question of the Greek hierarchy? So this sort of dichotomy between the larger group, obviously the faithful in the church, but the fact that the church was ruled by a minority coming from different places.
Yeah, so this is something that is covered by a chapter in the book by another member of the Crossroads Project, so the project at Leiden that was funded by the Dutch Research Council with Karen as the PI. And that's Kostas Papastatis from Aristotle University. And he's very much a specialist of this question of the role of the Greek Orthodox Church in Palestine at this point in time. And so there had been, and again, there's quite a substantial literature on this, but there had been since much earlier in the 19th century, this kind of tension and indeed conflict in the Greek Orthodox Church over the fact that the hierarchy of the church was almost entirely Greek Orthodox. Some senior members maybe even came for senior roles in the church without speaking any Arabic, even though the majority of the huge majority of the actual congregations at this time are Arabic speaking, and there's something called the Brotherhood of the Holy Sepulchre, which is a specific kind of subgroup within the hierarchy of the Greek Orthodox Church in Jerusalem. And this was almost entirely closed to Arab clergy, but also it was extremely necessary to be a member or very close to this in order to be promoted to some of the most senior positions, including the Patriarchate. So so Khoury is very much part of this movement that, as I said, has been growing since the 19th century to, we might say, kind of indigenize the Greek Orthodox Church. And this was something that was very much contested by the leaders of the church in Istanbul and then in Greece, because of obviously the kind of status of Jerusalem and the Holy Land, and the fact that there's, you know, a lot of prestige and a lot of importance attached to kind of who gets to maintain control of these elements of kind of Greek Orthodox church practice. It's, you know, obviously it's a major site for pilgrimage, so there's large numbers of Orthodox pilgrims visit Palestine, not just from the Ottoman Empire and former Ottoman Empire places like Greece, but also especially from Russia. And it's very much a kind of subject which gets tied up with also European colonialism, Russian politics, Russian relationships between Tsarist Russia and the Ottoman Empire and these kind of things. So, you know, there's the level of somebody like Nicholas Khoury in terms of kind of trying to push upwards as an ordinary member of the church. And then there are kind of other pressures and conflicts going on that are really on the level of sort of international diplomacy and international conflicts.
I'm also curious a little bit about the question of the role of Christianity in Palestine. And perhaps you can tell us a little bit more about the role of Christians in Palestinian society and politics, just at large and not just focusing on the Greek Orthodox Church.
Charbel?
Yes, maybe before I would like to add one more element to what Sarah said. For the Greek Orthodox Patriarchate of Jerusalem, education, pastoral work, and charity was not really important for them. That's why when we read all that journal, we see how much the education is important for Nicola Fure. The schools, he always said as the schools in Jerusalem was not very good, etc., etc. The school here is very good. So it's very important, the education. That's why in the 20th century, many Greek Orthodox were converted to Greek, to be Greek Catholic, because Grigorios Hajar gave them schools. And if you read the correspondences and the letters between the Greek Orthodox and Grigorios Hajar, they were asking for two things: for a priest who can speak Arabic, who can preach, and for schools. So that's why always we see in this journal that Nicola Fure was a very good priest. A lot of person liked his homilies, and he was trying always to give a better quality for teaching. To answer about your question, Roberto, in general about Palestine, the Christians were like mosaics. So we have Greek Catholic, Greek Orthodox. We have also Latins, some Maronites, and also we have Anglicans. We have Armenian, we have Ethiopian. So we have many tradition, many culture implanted in Palestine. And of course, because it's the Holy Land, it will be most important to be present, to venerate the holy places, the Jerusalem, the temple, etc., the Holy Sepulchre. Maybe Sara, you would like to add something?
Yeah, so I mean, as Chobel says, in some ways, Christianity in Palestine is very complex. There's lots of different communities. Sometimes they can work together, sometimes they are in competition. But in terms also of especially the mandate period, and in terms of the wider politics that are going on in Mandate Palestine, the rise of the Zionist movement, and especially political Zionism, and the increasing amount of Jewish immigration that's happening during the Mandate period. We also see Christians, for instance, are extremely active in Palestinian nationalism, in anti-colonial movements within Palestine. So, for instance, we see that quite often the editors of the major newspapers, such as Philistine, are from Christian communities. We see a lot of Christian, Palestinian Christians involved in the various kind of nationalist political or social or cultural movements. And you know, there's this kind of stereotype, I think, nowadays, in the 21st century, of Palestinian nationalism as something that is kind of very heavily dominated by Islam and Muslims. And actually, during this period, it's very diverse, and there are Palestinian Christians, whether they are Protestant, whether they are Latins, whether they are Greek Orthodox, whether they are Greek Catholic, involved in many different strands of trying to kind of defend the idea of Palestinian identity and the kind of Palestinian right to national self-determination, you know, in the face of the British Mandate administration.
Well, we cover the context, and I really want to go back to the memoirs and obviously Nicola Khoury. I was just wondering, Nicola Khoury lived through a number of different eras, I would say, through the late Ottoman period, the British Mandate, including the end of the British Mandate and the creation of the State of Israel, and also obviously the division of Palestine, you know, with Gaza under the Egyptians and the West Bank under the Jordanians. How did he experience these various changes?
Oh, okay. You're okay. So, I mean, there are huge changes that go on in Khoury's life. He sees the Young Turk Revolution. He sees World War One. He experiences kind of all of the things that go on during the British Mandate in terms of the politics of Zionism and Palestinian nationalism, and then of course World War Two and the Nakba. So. He plays some very interesting roles in some of these. So, for instance, if we look at his experiences of World War One, as Charbel mentioned earlier, he gets this kind of quite responsible position in terms of looking after stores. And he kind of very openly, and I think in a sort of quite anti-Ottoman way, perhaps, admits that then he also puts his brother in charge of some other stores and you know, and that they're able to, in some ways, survive parts of the war and the famine because they have access to these military warehouses. So sometimes he's quite a skilled operator at kind of taking opportunities. But then during the mandate period, I think he spends a lot of time, it feels like he spends a lot of time being quite angry and quite frustrated, whether it's by the British authorities, whether it's because of the Greek hierarchy in the church. And you kind of get the feeling from the way that he writes that he sort of always wanted to have power and to have influence and to be able to push events, and that this never really kind of happened in the way that he hoped. And I think we maybe see this also in terms of how he experiences the Nakba, and he manages kind of through his relationships with some of the members of the church in Lebanon to get a parish in Lebanon and to, you know, so to be able to at least have somewhere to live and an income in the way that many refugees, Palestinian refugees from the Nakba didn't. But he goes to, you know, he ends up, you know, really quite low status. You know, it's a village that he has. He's not in the kind of position that he aspired to or that he had had at times within Jerusalem. So he very much has an experience in the final years of his life of going from feeling that maybe he's quite a lot at the center of events to being quite marginalized. And, you know, we were talking about it earlier and Charbel did comment that perhaps even in some ways, maybe getting the parish that he's given in Lebanon, that perhaps that it was maybe on, you know, kind of on the condition that he didn't say anything too controversial, that he didn't speak out and these kind of things. So, you know, I think obviously, you know, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians suffered in different ways during the Nakba. But in terms of his kind of experience of the way in which the first half of the 20th century plays out for Palestinians, I think he's somebody who sort of rose and then very much kind of lost a lot of his position, in contrast, for instance, to sort of some of the nationalist leaders that we see who, you know, continue to be in influential roles, somebody like, say, Arafat Arif becoming mayor of Jerusalem and you know, these people who find other political niches. He very much becomes somebody who is quite marginal for the final years of his life.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com. bookstagram.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Thank you. I don't want to add a lot of things, but when we read the journal of Nicolas Khoury, we could imagine that he wants us to know that he played a crucial role to avoid the partition of Palestine when he traveled to Geneva and he visited many countries, Serbia, Greece, Romania, to inform the government of these countries, people, leaders, about the danger of threatening the holy places since the seizure of the country by the Jews. And either when he talked about Nakba, and we say that he spoke a little bit about Nakba because after that he returned to, he traveled to Lebanon. He tried to form a committee among the Christian clergymen, including all the communities, to protest against these attacks. We have the impression Khoury wants to say that he did all his best to prevent Jerusalem or Palestine from the Judaization of the Holy Land, but all what he did, he couldn't attain. It didn't work.
And actually, this makes me wonder about one question about how do we read these memoirs? In other words, how do you think this narrative has been mediated? And are there any sort of parts that we should be skeptical of? I mean, this is like, it's always the problem of reading diaries and memoirs and trying to understand, what kind of pinch of salt we need in order to make sure that we have a correct understanding and also understanding the context behind the memoirs in this case.
Shall I take the first part of the question and you take
second? Yes, no problem.
So in terms of kind of how these memoirs have been mediated, I think firstly, we know from his own account that Khoury says that he kept diaries or journals in some ways from quite early in his life, but that they are destroyed at several points in his life. So he writes things and then they're lost. So we know that this is sort of a final version, as it were. So it's something that is written largely after the Nakba. He's probably framing elements of what he wants to say according to historical events and according to a certain amount of sort of looking back over things. As Chabelle has mentioned, you get the sense that he very much wants to indicate that he did all that he possibly could. And I think as Chabelle will discuss a bit more, maybe even overstates that quite often, to put it mildly. I think there's some interesting aspects of that whole question because, we do think that probably this manuscript was written towards the end of his life, so in the early 1950s, and that does raise issues around the fact that, for instance, when he's travelling through the Balkans to Geneva, and we talk about this, we might talk about this in a bit, but, he is asking for support from people who then a few years later are very probably involved in the Holocaust of the Jewish communities of the Balkans, in Romania and other parts of the Balkans. So, there are aspects of this that are very problematic in terms of what hasn't been mediated in different ways. And then, of course, there's just the basic fact that this is translated. It was a manuscript and then it was transliterated by Charbel in order to give us a version to use, and then it's been translated. That was very much a collaborative process between 3, 4, 5 people. And the annotations, again, there's work there from Karen, from Charbel, from Costas, from myself. So, you know, we've kind of tried, I guess, to do as much justice as possible to the original version. But, you know, translation, as many people have discussed and written about, is, you know, can be seen as a colonial act, can be seen as an aggressive act. So, you know, we tried to be as close as we could to what he was writing. And having people like Kostas and Chabel, I think, was very, very important because of their specialisms in the particularly the religious side of things, which is something that I don't particularly have. And the fact that this is something that's incredibly important to him. And so I think, you know, in some ways, there's a lot of language in there that is very, very specialist, because it's, you know, it's about the practices of Christianity in a particular environment, and that many of us from outside that won't understand. And so, I mean, having Chabel and Kostas there to really sort of contribute how to engage with some of the terminology and the sort of the feeling behind that as well, I think is really important.
My turn. Yes, thank you. In fact, Roberto, every time Nicholas Khoury shows us as a hero, we should be skeptical. Skeptical doesn't mean that he is a liar, but we should be a little bit more attentive for what he's saying. Nicholas Khoury considers his person more important and valiant than all others, and bring everything, every event back to himself. Thanks to me, we could do that. Thanks to me, we avoid these problems as Muslims. Thanks to me, etc., etc. And even when Khoury visits the king of Jordan, Abdullah, he mentions that the king proposed him to become the patriarch of the Arab and said he was ready to make this happen. So a king, a Muslim king, proposed to a married priest to become a patriarch. It's a real illusion. It's not normal. It's not normal. I think King Abdullah and even any simple person would not propose this thing. So we can say that Nicholas Khoury has a big ego, and he wants always to... I feel that, of course, Nicholas excelled in teaching and pastoral services, but for his political engagement, it's clear that he believed he played a crucial role in the national struggle. But in fact, we don't know a lot of things about him. When you open an encyclopedia about Palestine, the 18th century, sorry, the 20th century, the Nakba, everything, you will see many articles or many mentions about Hajar, Gregorius Hajar. But we will not see anything talking about Nicholas Khoury. And if we talk about Nicholas Khoury, he was in this committee, only this. So I think, for example, also when he said, when he visited Romania, Serbia, many journals take pictures of him, kisses her hand, etc., etc. And our team tried to search in these journals in this period. We didn't find anything. So it was really interesting to say that he was not always honest in what saying. He will try to keep, let us say, he's a star. He's a star like Hajar or other person. But I don't feel that it's true. I don't feel that it's true. And sometimes he do some wrong ecclesiastical things. For example, when he traveled to Egypt without the permission of his patriarch, it's forbidden. It's not normal to travel and to serve in a church without the permission of your patriarch. And or, for example, when he participated to a marriage and the patriarch was present and he didn't mention him. It's not normal. So I think that sometimes Nicolas Khoury didn't say all things. Always he told us a part of the reality. Thank you.
And I think to add to that, I mean, I would stress we spent a lot of time looking at Arabic newspapers, Serb newspapers, Romanian newspapers. There's, you know, there's been many people, including the PI of Shaba's new project, Ioana Fedorova, in Romania, tried to find in various Orthodox archives as well, and if we find mentions of him, they are really small. And, you know, again, in the question of mediation and the fact that this is mainly written in the 1950s when he is very much outside, you know, you kind of start to wonder if this is a bit like, you know, your uncle who's, you know, war stories have him as the great hero of something rather than, you know, one of the followers. And, you know, Khoury's been sidelined and been marginalized, but he wants to see himself as Superman.
Roberto, please go ahead.
Yes, if I may, I want only to read one paragraph from the introduction talking about this matter. The use of the Arabic expression, "we had a shining place among them, among other priests," underlined the degree to which Nicolas was seemingly obsessed with his own importance. Details such as the story of the highest governor and the mutasarrif coming to school to attend his classes are unlikely to be totally truthful. His megalomania strikes again when he considers that none of the former priests could be found worthy, indeed were worthless, after he and Khalil Hakim were ordained and took up their position in Jerusalem. This observation is far from any Christian spirit that Father Nicolas should have shown towards his colleagues. Thanks.
Well, it sounds that he was some sort of a self-proclaimed larger-than-life character, and then obviously maybe history will tell us that in fact he was like this very important historical figure. I have a question about a trip that you already mentioned several times. So in 1937, Khoury traveled to Eastern Europe and also to the League of Nations in Geneva, in Switzerland. Can you tell us a little bit more about what was the purpose of the trip and also its outcome?
So in 1937, the League of Nations debated the idea of partitioning Palestine between Arabs and Jews for the first time as a kind of formal proposal. Up until then, the idea was of the mandate, the sort of mandate structure, was that Palestine would be a land that at some point in the future under the mandate system would be ruled by Jews and Arabs together in some way. No one really knows what vision the British had, if indeed they actually had a vision for it. But as the situation became more and more difficult, especially during the Palestinian uprising of 36 to 39, people started to say, okay, maybe instead of trying to create a single, what would now be termed a single state solution, we need to partition the land. And there was the first of the debates about this in 37 at the League of Nations in Geneva. Now, obviously, the Zionist movement has a delegation, and also there is it's not really a Palestinian delegation, it's more of an Arab nationalist delegation. It's actually, to some extent, headed up by, and I think it's Adel Aslan, not Shakib Aslan. It's one of the Aslan brothers, and I always get it wrong. And then you have Palestinian figures like Auni Abdel Hadi, who go, and some of those go direct to Geneva. You know, they are a delegation who are in Geneva for all of the proceedings, and there's various different stages. What Khoury is asked to do instead of this is to go overland. So he gets the train, and this is a kind of fascinating account in its own right, but he gets the train from Palestine up through Syria, and through Istanbul and then through the Balkans. And as we've mentioned before, he visits leaders of the Orthodox churches in some of these countries, and he visits politicians who are of Orthodox faith, and asks them to support the Palestinian side in this debate. So he goes to Serbia and Greece and Romania and I think Bulgaria, and visits a number of politicians and church leaders. And, you know, he has varying experiences. Some of them seem to be very positive, others less so. He then goes to Geneva for the actual debate and vote. And there he is, as we've described, possibly he overstates his own kind of prominence during the debate, but he's there as part of the Palestinian delegation during it, and also comments on the fact that the Zionist organization have a presence there, and it's very interesting in terms of his description of the actual events there. And he talks about people like Eamon de Valera, the Irish nationalist leader, making a speech in support of the Palestinians as well, which you know did happen. He was very supportive of the Palestinian position at various times. So it's a really interesting kind of glimpse of kind of a quite a pivotal moment in Palestinian history there.
I have a couple of more questions, and one is about chapter 2 of this book. Chapter 2 looks at Arab Orthodox in Palestine and Jordan through the lenses of the Frank Schulten photographic collection of 1921-1923. Can you tell us a little bit more about this particular photographic collection? Why is it included in the book, and what does tell us?
Okay, so this chapter was prepared by Sari Zananiri, who is another member of the Crossroads Project, and he's been working very much on this Frank Schulten archive, which is held by the Dutch Near East Institute. The reason we wanted to include this is that despite his statement that there were lots of photographs published in the newspapers of him in the Balkans, we actually couldn't find any image of Nikola Khoury. We don't really know what he looked like. But what we do have from various places, but particularly from Schulten, is a sense of the Greek Orthodox presence in Palestinian life in a very day-to-day way. So Schulten was in Palestine for these 2 years, as you said, 21 to 23. And as various scholars have commented, including people like Salim Tamari and Yair Wallach, he, more than really any other photographer of the period, he gives a really kind of day-to-day, almost sort of intimate sense of just what a street looks like, what normal life looks like in this particular moment. And the fact that he is taking these photos in Jaffa, in Jerusalem, in other parts of Mandate Palestine, and we see the presence of Greek Orthodox priests, Greek Orthodox processions, just the everyday life of Greek Orthodoxy within the wider Palestinian society, I think is quite important in terms of getting across the fact that although Khoury kind of very much talks about himself in this very prominent role, we also have to remember that he is absolutely a part of society, a part of culture, a part of politics. And even if none of these photos are of Khoury, we don't know that. Maybe some of them are, which would be very exciting, but I don't think we have a way of knowing that. But it kind of shows the sort of setting that he was part of and that he's in. So at least gives us a sort of sense visually of the environment that at least part of these diaries are set in.
I'm curious, and this is a question for both of you, what are the most remarkable stories to be found in the memoirs? Anyone of that is your favorite?
I'm going to jump in here because my example is quite boring and historical, whereas I think Charbel's is really beautiful. So my one is his account of life in Kerak, because I think that's really quite unusual in terms of a first-person narrative of late Ottoman Kerak from a Greek Orthodox position. Yes, maybe he is overstating his role in the Committee of Union and Progress there and his relationship with the Mutasarrif and things, but I think it gives a really interesting moment that you wouldn't find in, I think, any other Palestinian memoir. And also when his family have to flee because of the counter-revolutionary uprising that's happened in Kerak at this point. So I think, you know, there's lots that's fascinating in here, but for me that sort of stands out just as a really unusual bit of history that, you know, it would be very, very hard to find anywhere else.
So for me, in fact, in this period, when we read the journal of Nicola Khoury, you know that he has two children, Mariam and Takla, but in fact, his wife also was pregnant for 4 times, and always the baby was born and then he was dead for many reasons. So at some point, Nicola Khoury said, "We planted as such a baby in every city we lived in, Kerak, Ramla, Jerusalem, and Birzeit." I felt very sorry for him when I read this sentence, especially in Arabic. "We planted." So it was really, I feel a lot of compassion for him when he's talking about, you know, in this period, no medicaments, no antibiotics. So it was not the same situation like our days. And I want to add something. I'm really a little bit tired, or a little bit, I don't know how. Sometimes we read that Nicola Khoury was in very good economic situation and suddenly he's poor. And then he is in very good situation, suddenly he's poor. I couldn't really understand the reasons. I was not totally convinced. Maybe this make the ego and exaggeration and all that made me more skeptical about his biography. But when I was talking to Sarah, we had the same idea. Sometimes he's very rich and sometimes he's very poor. But the most important, in both cases, he was always okay. He was always thanking God for what he lives in.
That's a fascinating story. I guess it's also a life experience of many, how you feel about your own personal wealth. I have a question about legacy. Can we talk about a legacy of Nicola Khoury? And if so, what that may be?
Yes. So when we talk about Nicola Khoury, in fact, I don't think that we know a lot of things about him. When you talk in Lebanon or Palestine about Ghouras Hajjar, you will know him. In fact, Nicola Khoury, when we read his journal, he say that he edited an collection, a book of prayers. In fact, until now, we are using his book in Orthodox churches for marriage, baptism, etc. So the legacy of Nicola Khoury is present in his book. His book was published many times. But also, I think that it's important also to mention that a part of this journal was published in Arabic in a book entitled Insaniyat Malak, or The Humanity of a King. It's a book about the life or the biography of the Sultan Abdul Aziz ibn Abdul Rahman As-Saud, the founder of the Arabi Saudite. And it seems that le petit-fils saw the author some way in Washington, and he gave him all this journal. So the author put in his book some passages to speak more about Abdul Aziz, how he was open to other religions. But in fact, until now, we don't have a real legacy of Nicolas Khoury. I don't know, Sara, if you have something to add.
No, I think that your point about the prayer book is something really interesting, because Khoury does talk about it in his memoir, but not for very long. You know, he publishes several books. There's this Arabic edition that he edits, and then he also, with his cousin, wrote a history of the Orthodox Church in Palestine, which is referenced quite often. But again, he only actually writes about this sort of maybe one or two paragraphs at most. And I think this is sort of interesting in that he has a legacy. You know, he has a legacy in that there are churches where he's part of people's lives every day or every week, but that's not the legacy he wanted, which is kind of sad, but is also sort of tells us about something, I think, about, you know, the human condition generally in terms of how we want to see ourselves and our own legacies. But, you know, that's in some ways what his legacy is. It's his, you know, his sort of vision of the Arab and Arabic language presence in the Orthodox Church. So, you know, he's there, but we, you know, people don't tend to recognize him as a name for doing those things, and they're not the things that he wanted to succeed in and be seen as important for.
These were Sarah Irving and Sherbel Nassif, that together with Karen Sanchez edited The House of a Priest, A Palestinian Life, 1885-1954, published by Brill and available in open access online. Sarah and Sherbel, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.